Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. Well, it's time for a little escape of the hardcover type. This hour, we're going to hide from a convict, sail through Scandinavia, and cruise the back alleys of Prohibition-era Boston. But we're also going to proclaim love in literature with some good reads for Valentine's Day, which is exactly 1 week from today. Our meeting comes with the Book Doctors, comes just 2 days after three leading publishers launched something called Bookish, a new online destination for lovers of good books. The doctors will give us their reaction to Bookish. Our Book Doctors today are Katie Stover. She's Director of Readers Services with the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library. Katie, always good to have you.
A pleasure to be here, Steve.
Lorenzo Butler is with us. He's a communication specialist, also with the library, and welcome. So good to have you here, Lorenzo.
Thanks for having me.
Welcome, yeah. And also back with us again is Grace Suh. She's a writer, editor, and blogger. And Grace, always good to have you, too.
Good morning, Steve.
Well, Katie Stover, big news today in the Wall Street Journal. Tell us about a library in Texas that is talking about having a library with no books.
The bookless library, yes.
The bookless library.
Boo. This is...
Uh-oh.
And there are
a great many
members of the public who would agree with you, Grace. The county commissioners in Bexar County, Texas, have proposed...
Bexar County.
It's my understanding it's pronounced Bear.
Bear, okay.
And I have that from my...
like Bexar.
I have that from my husband
like
who lived there.
Okay.
But if I'm wrong, someone call in and correct either of us. But it's what the county commissioners in that county want to do is open a bookless library. It will have computers. It will have 150 e-readers for patrons to check out. 50 of those e-readers will be dedicated to youth materials. And the it's my understanding that the county commission's goal is to provide library services in a southern part of Bexar County where there's a lot of unincorporated villages and towns. And it's not that they don't have library services, because San Antonio Public Library in Bexar County covers all of that county. But it's these residents are rather far from any of the city library branches. So that's what the county commissioners would like to do. They're proposing opening their bookless library in a currently vacant county building that they have in southern Bexar County, and they want to open it this fall. They think it'll cost them $1.5 million.
And what do you make of this? Lorenzo Butler, is this the future of the public library as we know it, or is this just an aberration here?
You know, I think it's going to be a little bit of both. I certainly don't think it's the future of the public library.
Yeah.
Librarians are very much still needed. As technology continues to evolve.
And presumably they would be needed even with a bookless library, I guess, to help people navigate that world as well.
They would, but I think, our library in particular offers so many different things. We offer tax services. We have people coming in running small businesses out of our business center. You have so many different things going on at the library, and you always need someone there to assist you. I don't think you can really get this out of just a bookless library. I'm not going to knock it, but I just don't think it's the wave of the future.
But I still wonder, even for a guy like myself who's dedicated a whole career to daily American journalism, I have found of late, and people might be surprised, I like to read my New York Times on my iPad as opposed to reading the physical version with the paper, which I never thought I would ever say. I prefer it, Katie. It's just an amazing development in my life.
Well, I prefer to read my New York Times that way, too, and my Kansas City Star.
Mm-hmm.
But it's now it's turning into a question of user preference of format. It's not that that readers will have to give up one format over another. Now it's a matter of preference. And we will find that the younger generation, their preference is definitely going towards more electronic. That's what they're used to. There are digital natives. Of course they're going to want to read on their iPads and their phones. And for them, reading on a phone is not a big deal. And I hear people say, I can't read on that tiny screen. Well, I totally hear you.
And, well, I guess that still raises the question. 20 years from now, is this a library in Texas? Is this the wave of the future going forward, Grace? What do you think?
Oh, I hope not. I mean, I brought my Kindle reader, and I read on the Kindle, and I love the Times Online.
Mm-hmm.
But I just think that there are certain things that a physical book can do that the electronic forms cannot do. And I use the electronic forms quite a bit because I use scholarly books that are $240 to buy, in the physical copy. But I can read it online, through a a library, a university library, five states over, and I'm very appreciative of that. And maybe there will come a time when people will say, "Can you believe they used to chop down trees and print on the paper and truck those books around, these physical objects, and fill their houses with them?" But, you know, a part of me hopes that doesn't happen.
Well, the first time I sort of – I'm still reading books, the physical book, and I suspect I will for a long time. But the first time I began to have second thoughts about that was last year reading Robert Caro's latest volume in the LBJ series. I mean, that book is a doorstop, and it's just cumbersome as all heck to try to hold and navigate.
Right.
And I began thinking maybe it's time for me to think about an e-book when it comes to something – this thick, you know?
Oh, well, I use my ebooks to psych myself out with those doorstop books, because I won't pick one up because it's daunting, but I'll download one to my iPad because then I can't really see how many pages it is. I don't know how far along I am. So I can manage this. It's just two pages on the screen.
Yeah.
This is
fine.
Well,
and you can't autograph, you know, a Kindle, you know, and that's another thing, too.
Oh, David Sedaris can and has.
I mean, that's, you know, my mother has a library at her house, and, you know, she has books autographed, you know, by so many different authors.
Yeah.
And there's something about being able to pull that book and go back to that memory of possibly meeting that author, you know, that is really special. And, you know, personally, I read on my iPad, but I'm not going to take the iPad to a beach or to the pool and read.
Right.
Or
I'm
in the bathtub.
One's made a waterproof iPad yet.
Yeah.
And I read a lot in the bathtub.
I still wonder if someday, if this indeed, this library goes forward, this is still in the planning stages, Katie, if I understand correctly.
It sounds like it is. They have definite plans they want to, but it is still in the planning stages. It was only announced last month in the San Antonio newspaper.
Well, if it does go forward, you wonder if this won't be a seminal moment in sort of the history of literature in America, because this is really kind of an amazing thing.
It is. It is amazing. It'll be neat to see where it goes and how Bexar County works out with that.
Yeah. Okay. So, let's go to some books and some of your picks for this month. Katie Stover, why don't you tell us about Griffin and Sabine?
Oh, Griffin and Sabine. That's one of my books of love. You want to talk about those?
Let's go to love first.
We're
a week from Valentine's Day. It's time.
Oh, Griffin and Sabine. This is the first in a short trilogy by Nick Bantock, and they have an unusual correspondence. They like to send, Griffin and Sabine send each other elaborately decorated postcards and letters and envelopes with exotic stamps. And Griffin is in England, and Sabine is, well, where exactly? We're not really sure. It's not a country you'll recognize. And it's a very unusual epistolary romance in which the readers get to remove the letters from the envelopes in the book, and they get to read Griffin and Sabine's long-distance love affair. And by the end, readers will be wondering, along with Griffin, who is this woman, and where does she live? And it comes with this absolutely stunning artwork, and I'm pulling one of the letters out of the envelopes now, that Nick Bantock has created. All of the postcards, all of the envelopes, all the stamps, the typefaces, the fonts for the handwriting. He's created all of this. This is a gorgeous, slim little book that for book lovers. And it's a pop-up book for adults about this unusual romance between these characters. And then it continues in two subsequent novels where will Griffin and Sabine finally meet up, and do they exist real? Are they truly people, or do they exist in each other's heads? Are they crazy? Hard to figure out.
Yeah.
But
you wonder if a book like that would have been made 15, 20 years ago. This is part of sort of a new wave, too, I think.
This book actually was published in 1991. And as I'm flipping through it, I'm thinking of Grace and how much she loves print. I don't think you can do a book like this electronically. You won't get the tactile sensations of Griffin and Sabine on your iPad. Could you point to the envelope and have the letter pop up? Yes, you could. But are you going to get the same invasive sense that you have opening their mail and reading it? This one might not work electronically.
Yeah.
But it's you could, 1991, and Nick Bantock sort of spurned a book as art movement.
Yeah.
I saw that quite a great deal in the 90s.
All right. And the title of that book again is?
Griffin and Sabine by Nick Bantock.
Okay. Well, Lorenzo Butler, you brought one, How the French Invented Love, 900 Years of Passion and Romance. God, you're an old softy at heart, aren't you?
Well, yeah, you could say that. This is partially for work, since Marilyn Yellen will be here next week. But I was saying yesterday that I'm pretty much allergic to the love books, so I don't, it's kind of weird for me. You should watch me read this book.
You'd be like me.
Yeah, it's kind of odd, but it is an interesting book, though. Just started to get into it, but Marilyn is exploring basically over 9 centuries how she feels the French, invented what it is that we call love today. And she talks about how, a French man and woman who are not amorous are kind of odd, which I guess if I was French, maybe, I don't know, I'd be odd. I don't know. But it is an interesting book, and it's interesting to see from the Middle Ages until today how, things have changed, but yet how things, have stayed the same, where it comes down to the basic concept of two people, being in a relationship and having mutual feelings for each other. So it is interesting. I will say, guys, it is definitely interesting. You should check it out.
So this question about whether the French did, in fact, invent love, the answer, I guess, is yes, it sounds like.
She's saying yes. I would, I would like to give America a little credit. No,
yeah, okay. Grace, what did you bring us today when it comes to this Valentine's Day season that we're in
right
now?
Well, I brought the famous love story, Splendors of China's Forbidden City.
Ah.
And right along the lines of what Lorenzo's saying about how love has changed and how it has stayed the same over the years, and also about love being between two people, I would posit that love is a relationship between among 16 people, because the emperors had... Well, I think it was 17. They would have an empress and then 15, that's 16, and then 15 consorts and concubines of all different ranks. And one had a different title and rank, and which accorded her a certain amount of privileges and possessions and responsibilities. And it was the protocol in the Qing court, this is the Qing dynasty, was so refined that it would say things like the empress can have 62 pearls of grade A luster, but the next consort down, the superior beloved consort can have only 72 pearls, but they're of grade 3 luster. And she can have only 400 pairs of shoes, and the consort below her can have only 260 pairs of shoes. And this went on.
Wow.
Down.
That's interesting.
Among the consorts.
Yeah.
And I just found it so interesting, and I've been reading a lot about the Qing dynasty and the Chosun dynasty in the 17th century. And then just to get a break from all of that, I've been reading Jane Smiley's Greenlanders, which is set in 1400s. And so I've been pretty immersed in what, academicians call early modern history, so much so that a couple of weeks ago, my friend was telling me about a problem that he had. He owns a lot of land in southern Missouri, but wants to buy the farm next door and is trying to persuade the farmer to sell it to him. And I said, well, does he have any marriageable sons? Well, that's what happened at the dinner party. People laughed, and I was not kidding, because he's got a daughter who's almost 12 years old. And she's a very nice girl, and I had meant it in all earnestness, and it wasn't until people laughed that I thought, okay, I need to read something maybe a little bit more contemporary.
What's been the big appeal to going back in time as much as you've been going that way?
Oh, I guess it is how very, very different things were back in those days. I mean, people got killed a lot. There were a lot of hardships, but also how, for instance, in the Qing dynasty, there's so much bureaucracy. There's so much paperwork.
Mm-hmm.
Things are modern to an extent that are just astonishing to me. Just all the things about how people would do their hair, and the Qings did not let their women have bound feet. And this to
have
me
what
is
feet?
Bound feet, because the Ming Dynasty women all had bound feet. Do you know the concept of Chinese bound feet? Where the women's feet were broken and buckled under, and so that they were 3¼ inches large. And this went on for centuries.
Ouch.
It was horrible. They were all basically crippled. The entire you know, upper class women of Ming, of the Ming dynasty were crippled. And so when the Qings came in, who were Manchurians, their emperors explicitly forbade that this would happen to the Qing dynasty women. And so it's so interesting to me that these Qing women were then so jealous of the Ming dynasty women who had bound feet that they wore these little tiny shoes and little tiny elevator platforms so that they could barely walk, so that they could mimic the, and I have my quote marks in the air, fashionable princing of the women with the bound feet. And to me, that's so contemporary, because if you look at women's shoes today, people are stomping around in 6-inch, 7-inch heels. And so you can never get away. The 20th century gaze says bound feet are evil and a horrible thing, and these women were subjugated. And then to read the contemporary accounts and realize that these other women were, you know, were jealous
of
it.
That's amazing.
Isn't it interesting?
Well, I'm guessing the day your feet were broken was probably not a really good day.
No. I mean, it's you know, another form of female mutilation. And it's a horrible, horrible thing. And, you know, I've always heard of it, you know, in women's studies and things. You see it as, you see it with 20th century, I guess I should say 21st century eyes. And see it as the horror that it was. And so it's very interesting to look on it through these contemporary accounts and see that they saw their lives as being very contemporary, just the same way that we do today.
Well, our book doctors are in the house today, Katie Stover, Lorenzo Butler, and Grace Suh. And if you want to join our conversation with a pick of a great Valentine's romantic read that might be just appropriate for Valentine's Day coming up, you're welcome to call 816-235-2888, our email address, UpToDate at KCUR.org, or go to KCUR's Facebook page. Katie, do you have anything else in the Valentine's Day realm, or do you want to move on to more real life here?
Well, I'll talk about that gangster book you mentioned earlier.
Okay. Yeah.
And then I can talk about my other, you know, librarian's books of love, Lust. But I brought Live by Night by Dennis Lehane, and that's the one you were talking about. It's a jazz age gangster noir, and it's a featured selection of the library's winter reading program this season. So think HBO's Boardwalk meets The Great Gatsby. And it revolves around Joe, who is the youngest son of a very high-placed Boston police officer. And he rebels against his middle-class, solid upbringing to become one of the city's most notorious criminals.
Mm.
And in his rise to the top of one of the East Coast's crime syndicates, he involves his father and a very gorgeous but steely gal from the tough side of the neighborhood. And after an eye-opening and lucrative stint in jail, Joe decamps to Ybor City in Florida, right outside of Tampa. And he starts to build his own criminal empire with his sights firmly set on Florida's tourist future. He's got notions. He's looking ahead. And this is a sweeping romantic tragedy. It's full of guns, rum, dames, and bootleggers. I dare any reader to take more than 2 days to finish it, because it just moves along at a roller coaster pace. I'm a notoriously slow reader. I finished it in 2 days.
But you're a librarian and you are a slow reader.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
And in recent news, I was really thrilled to hear this. Ben Affleck is adapting Live by Night for a film.
No kidding.
So he's a big fan of Dennis Lehane's work. And apparently Dennis Lehane is a fan of his work, too. Ben Affleck's adapted Gone Baby Gone, and he's going to work on Live by Night, and he's really it's a very cinematic book. It's got really wonderful history and a great sense of place, and it's dark.
It sounds terrific. Live by Night by Dennis Lehane, right?
Yes.
Again, our number here, 816-235-2888. Let's go to Roger from Overland Park. Roger, you're on the program. Good morning.
Hey, good morning to you. I wanted to step back a little bit and offer some information about the great debate between electronic and physical books. I realize you've sort of moved past that, but I couldn't get to the phone sooner. I remember reading a study some years ago about the retention of information from electronic sources versus physical books, and what they found was that the position of information on the page, whether it's next to pictures, where it is in the book, actually aided the retention of information. And unfortunately, I can't give you a citation, but I can give you a keyword search. The phenomena was called cognitive mapping. Hmm. And they seem to demonstrate that you could retain information better from a physical book than you could from an electronic source.
But, you know, sometimes, my iPad has, pictures, with New York Times stories. There's some of that, those elements now, Roger, incorporated in what I'm looking at in an electric book form.
That would be true, but something I remember as a former teacher is they said if you can harness more senses, you can harness, the better you can teach something.
Yeah, that's interesting.
So if you can hear it, if you can smell it, feel it, touch it, you're going to remember it better. And I think this cognitive mapping may go to that.
Yeah. Well, good suggestion, Roger. Thanks for making it. Appreciate it.
Sure.
Okay. Lorenzo Butler, you've got several good books here up. What do you want to talk about next?
We can start with, I guess, my favorite book that I've been reading recently, which is Cronkite by Douglas Brinkley.
Yeah, he was in here talking about this book a number of months ago. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's a fantastic book, and I think anyone who has a love affair with Kansas City should actually read this book. You'd be amazed to find out how much Walter Cronkite loved Kansas City.
Isn't that the truth?
Yeah.
Deep ties here.
Absolutely. Yeah. And he started, worked at a local radio station, KCMO, in the 30s and went on. But, two things that struck me. Number one, with his love affair of Kansas City is the fact that no matter where he went for the rest of his life, he kept his watch on Kansas City time, which I thought was just awesome.
Oh,
that's a neat story.
Yeah, it's awesome. And, number two, what struck me about the book was the fact that, we all remember Cronkite as being a great journalist, but he was very – very insecure early on in his career. And, he looked at Edward Murrow and, was just like, God, I want to be that person someday. And now in our thoughts, he has surpassed Edward Murrow. But he worked his tail off and it was, at the sacrifice of some personal things. He had a great wife that, was by his side for most of his life, and he had children, but he sacrificed time with the children to become the best. So I just think it's an interesting book. I know people read self-help books, but I think this is actually a great book to check out if you, are in a position where you're in a career and you're trying to progress and you can read about one of the great journalists of our time and how he kind of struggled early on to kind of get his footing in a career that, he grew to dominate. So,
And Kay Barnes, our former mayor here in Kansas City, of course, a relative of Walter Cronkite's,
yes,
and brought Walter Cronkite back to Missouri to campaign for her when she ran for Congress and I think even for mayor back in the day.
Yes.
So certainly those ties there. And it's hard for us to almost appreciate just how much impact, how much power, in a sense, a news anchor person could have back in those days. That's changed so much. But boy, in those days, Walter Cronkite was just so significant of a personage.
Absolutely. And, he started out in radio and, well, actually started out with newspapers. He was writing for UPI and then got into radio with KCMO and was right there when television was born and made the decision to go into television when others thought television was going to be a silly format to get into. You need to stick with radio, stick with newspapers. That's
ebooks will never take off.
Yeah, exactly. I feel like they might replay this in 30 years and hear me saying this. Yeah. Ebooks are terrible. But he was there at the turn of television, and he became the man that gave America the news of JFK's assassination, and showed emotion while giving that news. Really endeared himself to the public.
One of the great moments in TV journalism history, that's for sure. You can find our interview with Cronkite biographer Doug Brinkley at kcur.org. We'll put a link to it on today's Book Doctors page there at kcur.org. Okay, time for a break. When we come back, we'll continue our good conversation with our book doctors. Lots of good books coming up, one by Dan Rather, another one about President Barack Obama. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR.
We're back. I'm Steve Kraske. If you missed yesterday's conversation about the changing role of women in the military or our latest installment of 90 Mile View, you can find those and all of our previous broadcasts at kcur.org. On tomorrow's program, our indie foreign and documentary film critics review their favorites on the silver screen this week. This hour, we're visiting with our book doctors. We're talking about some good Valentine's Day reads, Valentine's Day being just a week from today. We're visiting with two folks from the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library, Katie Stover and Lorenzo Butler, and also our buddy Grace, writer, editor, and blogger. If you have great recommendations for a good read or one including that might cover Valentine's Day, give us a shout, 816-235-2888, or send us an email to updatedate@kcur.org. Grace, talk to us about In Other Words by Christopher Moore.
Well, this is a great book for lovers of words.
Mm.
And I just
lots of words.
I just love words like books like this. It takes the concept of untranslatable words.
Mm.
So every language has words that are difficult to express in other languages. And so,
for example,
the word sisu, which is a Finnish word, and it's a word that means the great confidence and great unfounded confidence that comes from being Finnish. And the example that they give is during the war between Finland and Russia, when there were two Finnish soldiers who found themselves against 40 Russian soldiers. And the one Finnish soldier said to the other, "We're in trouble." And the other one said, "I know it's going to take us all day to bury all of them."
New Yorkers understand sisu.
Yeah.
So it's these funny little words that are culturally specific.
That's a great story.
And here's an example. I did not know this, and I'm going to ask my brother, who is fluent in Japanese. But according to the book, there is no Japanese word for water. There is only the word mitsu for cold water and oyu for hot water.
Interesting.
I know.
There you go.
And I just love stuff like this. And
you were just full of fun facts today, Grace. Huh?
Hey. Mm-hmm. And so it's broken down by language, and most of you who know Yiddish know this word, but it's one of my favorite, nachas, which means the great joy and pride that comes in being a parent. So if your kid comes home with a good report card or happens to say thank you when someone gives, given a gift, as a parent, you feel nachas, which is a very useful word that doesn't exist in other languages. In Arabic, for instance, there's a word bukra, which I really like a lot, and it literally means tomorrow. But they use it to mean when God wills. And that can be an indeterminate amount of time, or according to, as the author put it, bukra is like mañana in Spanish, but without the same sense of urgency.
Yeah. Okay. Wow.
I found that funny.
That book again, In Other Words by Christopher Moore. So many good books and so little time, right, Katie Stover?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
I want that book.
Yeah, it sounds terrific, doesn't it? What else you got for us, Katie?
I brought a book to hopefully stave off the Game of Thrones fans. It's called The Iron King by Maurice Druon. And it's you can look for this next month. And George R.R. Martin has said that this is the original Game of Thrones.
Mm-hmm.
And this is actually an older novel. It's the first, The Iron King, the first in a series called The Accursed Kings. And it's a 7-book series. It's historical fiction, very similar to Game of Thrones in scope, without the fantasy. And it's a bloodthirsty and passionate two families, the Capets and the Plantagenets. And I said it was the first in a French series of books. They were extremely hard to find in English in the United States. And last I read in the introduction to The Iron Kings, the 7th book was never translated into English. But I'm sure with George R. Martin's blessing, these books are going to find, all six after The Iron King will find English translations that are just top notch, and they'll be published very quickly. But it's a pretty long series. It's pretty intense, and this should definitely satisfy those Game of Thrones readers and watchers who are looking for the next book in that series. And it's probably going to be a while, since Mr. Martin is probably still working on the latest book. But if you like, there's no fantasy elements in this, but if you like the plotting, the machinations of those royals, it's mind-boggling, it's compelling, and it'll keep you going seven books strong. So you're looking for The Iron King by Maurice Druon in March of this year.
And something tells me Lorenzo Butler is not a fan of all of that, but I'm just guessing.
I will smile through it, and
I will encourage others to get it.
Yeah.
Okay. You know about it now, so you can tell your Game of Thrones friends about it. That's the point.
Which I do have some friends that.
There you go. Lorenzo, what else you got there?
Kind of following in the theme of my life, I guess. You guys are seeing this through these books. But Rather Outspoken, My Life in the News by Dan Rather, another person who came to Kansas City over the past year. And, you know, in speaking to him, I was really excited to read the book. And again, you know, you're looking at people that, you know, are household names in this country and have done great things. And, you know, were just like all of us at one point in time.
Yeah.
They're regular people. And his book is very honest. He talks about...
He's been through a whole lot of stuff, Lorenzo.
He has.
What a fall from grace.
Yeah. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. But, you know, and he remained dignified through everything. And it's funny, you know, he talks about, you know, his big break in journalism when he was covering a hurricane in Texas, through getting his big break nationally when he took over for Cronkite, and talking about the pressure of taking over for someone who was a legend. And then, you know, he honestly talks about... his departure from CBS. And, you know, it's fascinating to hear something through a man's voice who rose and then fell and is now trying to rise again, you know, this late in the game, so to speak.
You know, just to tie your two picks that you've talked about so far today, you also talked about Douglas Brinkley's book, Cronkite, in our first half today. Isn't there a great scene in the Cronkite book about the tensions between Walter Cronkite and Dan Rather, and Dan Rather's first night taking over the news from Walter Cronkite when he was monkeying with the set just moments before he went on and just seconds before the camera went on and he sat down to take Walter Cronkite's place, and just lots of sort of unusual things like
that. Yeah, he had some, you know, there's a million things going on with him, and it actually started, I'd say, a couple of nights before then when Cronkite signed off and said something to the effect of, I'll see you later. And that was taken as a shot at Rather, that Rather was not going to be able to hold the job. Cronkite might come back. You know, he was given it maybe a year or two to see. And the rest of the country was given it just a year or two to see if he could, you know, fill those shoes. So from that point on, I mean, he was kind of backhanded, you know, on Cronkite's sign off with the whole country watching. And then leading up to the moments, right before he went on, and just having, you know, just a million emotions and trying to get things right. And I think that, again, is what's fascinating to me, because I grew up with Dan Rather more so than Cronkite. But I grew up with him being the face, you know, in the evening news, watching TV, and just to know that he struggled with that.
Yeah.
It's just amazing.
Yeah.
Just amazing.
Well, I'm old enough to remember Dan Rather's first book, which I think was The Camera Never Blanks, back and maybe out in the 80s. And I, you know, just absorbed that book. I was so interested in all that stuff. So that book, again, Rather Outspoken, My Life in the News by Dan Rather, right?
Absolutely, yes.
Okay. Grace.
Oh, well, this is a big switch.
The floor is yours.
Everybody, you know, put the brakes on. I want to talk about George Saunders' book,
10th of December.
And this is a book that I've been looking forward to for months and months and months. And it finally came out a couple of weeks ago. And as you can see, I did not have to wait for my copy to arrive from Amazon, nor did I have to go to Barnes & Noble. I downloaded it immediately onto my Kindle. So there you go.
Wow.
Because that's instant gratification.
Traitor.
And And I will say a couple of things. Most of these short stories were published initially in The New Yorker, but it's wonderful to read them again and in the context of the larger collection. The second thing is a lot of people may have heard of this particular collection, even though, well, he's always been popular in the past, but never a household name. I dare say most people do not know who George Saunders is. However, he got a huge burst of publicity a couple of weeks ago when he was reviewed in the New York Times under the title, The Best Book You Will Read This Year.
Wow. Yeah. And this is about what? You say a collection of his pieces
from
The New Yorker.
It's a collection of short stories.
And pieces like what? Like what kinds of stories?
Well, I will... The thing about George Saunders is nobody else writes like him, first of all. And I know that doesn't tell you much. But what he does is he strips the short story down and breaks so many rules, and never for formalistic reasons, always to get to the emotional heart of the story. So they're almost always told in third person, but from very much from the subjective point of view of the character that you're looking at.
These are fiction stories.
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Very fictional because they're very surreal. For instance, in this story, Escape from Spiderhead. Now, the thing about George Saunders is that he spent decades writing for corporations. And so he's very skilled in this corporate speak that floods us all around, this weird, quasi-formal corporate speak. And so a lot of his short stories are told in this weird corporate speak and about very sinister things. So Escape from Spiderhead is a scientific laboratory where they are injecting pharmaceuticals into you, and you don't know what the pharmaceutical is, but there's one I think called it's very ironic that I can't remember the name of it because it makes you more articulate.
Oh.
And so the person will within seconds of injection go from saying it was a very nice time to it was an extraordinary occasion on which I felt elevated and as never before, and felt at one with all of humanity in a way that brought to mind what Plato says.
Mm-hmm.
And so all these people are undergoing these pharmaceutical tests, and it's very surreal, but the thing that makes it so powerful is it's only two steps removed from reality.
Mm-hmm.
And yet they all have this incredible emotional payoff. It's never satire. It's always, in the end, a very human story.
Well, the best book you'll read this year is titled, again, 10th of December by George Saunders. Right?
And can I just tell you what he said about the title of that review? He said, it's absolutely true if you read no other book this year.
George Saunders said that.
That's right.
Yeah. Okay. Not a bad retort. That's pretty good. That's pretty good. Okay, Katie.
Oh, yes. Are we on Books of Love, or do you want to hear about some more of the thrilling, gory stuff that I brought along?
Just depends what mood you're in right now, I guess.
Okay, yeah. Well, I'll talk about more of the gory stuff.
I should move my seat then.
Yeah.
Talk gory stuff.
Uh-oh.
Steven Steigman mentioned this one to me when I was chatting with him yesterday. And When She Was Good by Laura Lippman. This is another one of the library's official winter reading selections, and the author will be visiting Kansas City Public Library later this month.
Mm-hmm.
But Laura Lippman is known for her Tess Monahan detective series. They take place in Baltimore. And she's been dabbling in standalone thrillers the way some of the other mystery writers have been doing, like Dennis Lehane and Harlan Coben, particularly Robert Crace, and she shares the same qualities in her standalones with them. They've got speedy plots, likable, recognizable characters in extraordinary situations. And in this one, our heroine, Helene Lewis, has been told by her father all while she was growing up that she has a nothing face and a nothing personality.
Mm.
Which sounds horrible if you're a child, except that Helene has discovered that those are pretty good qualities to have if you want to run a high-priced call girl service for some of Washington, D.C.'s highest-placed officials.
And why not?
So, and she's not the only one either, as she starts to learn from the newspapers when a killer starts stalking these Beltway madams, and Helene could be next. So this is a page turner that offers up some new information about the world's oldest profession. It's not condoning it, but you're going to think a little differently about those Hollywood madams and how they run their businesses. They're like these little mini corporations. They've got IRAs. They've got unemployment. They've got medical plans. And it just moves along at a crackerjack speed. I've been reading a lot of thrillers this winter, and this was
helps you get you through the winter, doesn't it?
It does. So, I mean, when I can't go out and work out, I would rather, you know, do biblio aerobics than regular aerobics. But And When She Was Good by Laura Lippman.
Okay, we just have a few minutes left, so let's sort of race through the final picks you guys brought today. Lorenzo, you wanted to talk about someone else who's been on the show, Jonathan Alter, a longtime writer for Newsweek, and the book is The Promise by President Obama, Year One, right?
Absolutely, yeah. It's a fantastic book, fantastic read. And Jonathan really explores the first year of the presidency for Obama.
The whole run-up to health care and everything else.
Absolutely. And health care is a big part of the book itself, talking about how Obama's advisors were strongly against him tackling that in his first year. And he was insistent on doing it. You know, Rahm Emanuel begged him not to do it. Pelosi begged him not to do it. But he was insistent on doing it. And, you know, it's funny to watch or to read this book because you're following a rookie employee, but he happens to be the president of the United States. Mm-hmm. So, you know, to watch someone in the first year of their job, which is being the leader of the free world, is amazing. And, you know, the disrespect that came from the military in some instances and having to break up, you know, potential altercations between congressmen. It was just it's amazing read.
The Promise, President Obama, Year One by Jonathan Alter. Grace?
Well, talking about books, I read a book called...
We are talking about books. No question about that.
I'm sorry, about work, about jobs. I read a book called Servants of the Dynasty, Palace Women in World History, and I'll just talk about one essay in it, which is about the women in the Korean Joseon Dynasty. It's fascinating. These were the only women ever before the 20th century to get paid for jobs. They were brought into the palace at the age of 6 or 7 and taught embroidery, taught how to cook, and most importantly, taught how to read and write. And so these women, because men were not considered fit to write women's history, these women wrote the history of the queens and princesses. And so all of the history of the queens and princesses in Joseon history were written by these women. These women secretaries who were literary, wrote biographies of the queens, and were the only ones in the entire country to have jobs that received salaries.
Wow. And that book, again, is titled?
Servants of the Dynasty, Palace Women in World History.
Okay. Sounds good. We're going to have to leave our conversation there, but I want to thank Katie Stover and Lorenzo Butler, both from the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library, and Grace Saw, a writer, editor, and blogger. Thank you all for coming in. Such a good conversation.
Pleasure.
Thanks
Great
for having
picks.
Us.
Yeah, you bet.